KCN, Talk Line Communications Network Radio, America's number one Jewish program.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Jay Booksbaum. You know me probably from wine and spirits, but I want to tell you something. Even though I'm in that area of expertise, you're about to hear from Rachama Bistritsky-Klapman, who runs MASS, Mothers and Fathers Aligned Saving Kids. They're in their 20th anniversary. They've got over 45,000 families that they've helped over the years. It's an amazing program. It's called Family Matters. And if you've got any issues with bullying or alcohol or substance abuse or any other kind of abuse, they're your place to go. I'm really excited to introduce you all to Rachama Bistritsky-Klapman here on Deb Brenner's Talk Line Communications Network every Thursday night at 9 o'clock. Listen to Rachama and Family Matters.
Good evening, listeners, and we're back with our show on Family Matters. And this evening, I have on Dr. Alexandra Straitner, who has a PhD and is a postdoctoral fellow in psychology. Her father is the famous Dr. Harry Straitner, and they are Straitner and Associates in New York City. Dr. Straitner is the Regional Clinical Vice President of Karen Treatment Center in New York as well. Alex, I'd like to welcome you on tonight. How are you?
Hi, I'm well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, we're very lucky to have you on. And this evening, we want to talk about treatment on anxiety and what happens when anxiety is not attended to properly, sometimes with young adults, and how they self-medicate and can go on illegal drugs, self-medicating. So for our listeners, tonight's show is going to be very exciting and very informative. And before we start, I want to remind everyone that MASK show is every Thursday night from 9 to 10 and on Family Matters. You can listen to our shows from the past several weeks on talklinecommunications.com. And MASK's number, for those that want to call for a referral, we're a helpline. You can call for a referral. You can give the number to a neighbor, a friend, someone you may sit next to in shul. The number is 718-758-0400. And our helpline is confidential from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. So, Dr. Alex, I'm wondering if we can start talking. I mean, you have a office at the Karen Foundation Treatment Center, I know, and that's for drug addiction, drug and alcohol. I'm wondering if we can start unravel it a little backwards to when somebody has anxiety and they're young, and they're in elementary school, and school may be difficult. Can you talk about the different kinds of anxiety? Anxiety that's school-related, or anxiety that may be part of your genes? Can we discuss that, please?
Sure. So, as with any kind of mental health concern, anxiety can be thought about as something that has biopsychosocial origins. And what I mean by that is that someone who has anxiety may have developed that anxiety because they have a genetic predisposition, or it's physiological, there's a biological or genetic component. It has a psychological component, that there are internal factors that are involved in someone's anxiety, the way that somebody experiences the world or their perceptions, their emotions, things that are internal to the person, intra-psychological, if you will. And then it also has a social component. As I would say all human beings know, we go through life, we have different stressors from young people. That might be things like peers, that might be school. And all of these factors can impact whether or not somebody develops anxiety. Now, in terms of types of anxiety, some types of anxiety we think maybe have more of a genetic predisposition, and some might be more socially or contextually triggered. So in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is the tome that is used to identify when somebody is experiencing distress, what is the diagnosis, there are multiple different kinds of anxiety disorders. Somebody can have a panic disorder where they have panic attacks. That's when they have these short periods of extreme distress with many physiological symptoms where they feel overwhelmed and they might feel like they're having a heart attack, but they're not. But we can also have generalized anxiety disorder. That's when, to put it in a sense, that's when somebody's a worrier. And they find that they're worrying much of the time about many different things, and it's having a negative impact on their quality of life. We can also have specific kinds of anxieties, like phobias, where, for example, with a kid, let's say that a child has to give a presentation in school. They might have a phobia or performance anxiety, or they might have social phobia when they hang out with their peers in a group, that they might feel anxious about spending time with groups of people, wondering how will this person think about me. So those are, in a broad sense, the different kinds of anxiety that we often are talking about. On top of that, there's another group of disorders that have recently been separated that's called the obsessive compulsive disorders. And so that looks a little bit more like somebody who has obsessions about certain thoughts, and they act out certain behaviors to feel like they have more control or that they're safe. And then we also have trauma-related disorders. That's just like people might have heard of PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's not an anxiety disorder anymore formally, but it's related to having worries that are driven by stressful or traumatic circumstances that someone might have experienced. So that's in many different ways what anxiety can look like.
So young children's anxiety that may be genetic, do they feel the same way as an adult? And do they act out differently when they're young than when they're teenagers or adults?
That's a great question. So children can experience anxiety like adults, but sometimes it manifests a little bit differently. And part of the reason for that, especially in the real youngsters, is that they don't necessarily have a vocabulary to describe what it is that they're experiencing. So whereas an adult, if I met with, you know, someone my age in my office, would say, I'm feeling anxious, I'm feeling worried about something, and they sort of have an awareness of what they're experiencing cognitively, or what the kinds of physical symptoms are, and they can name them. Little kids sometimes can't do that because they don't necessarily have an emotional vocabulary to. And so it can look to an outside observer like a number of different things. For example, you might see a little kid fidgeting, and for listeners, I'm sure people have heard about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. In a little kid, anxiety could look kind of like ADHD. It's not. But the observable behavior, fidgeting, you know, squirming around when they're sitting in their seat in class, or I heard you mention shul earlier, and shul, these are things that could look like a kid's having difficulty paying attention, but underlying that, it could be anxiety. So we have to help children be able to have an emotional vocabulary so that they can say when they're feeling something to an adult who can help them, I'm feeling really anxious, or I'm feeling scared, or something is worrying me. And when children have the words to say that, they unlock the ability to access help.
Right. So what you're saying is that we need to teach the kids, the young children, when they're young, how to express themselves so that if there is a child that may experiencing some fearfulness or anxiousness, then that child will be able to be more clear to their parent or their teacher what they're feeling, or they're in camp even. Kids are going now to camp. There are plenty of kids that parents, you know, send them to camp, sleepaways, and they may be anxious about going. Can that be a little different than the child that has anxiety?
Absolutely. And you make a very important point that I left out, which is that in addition to the other kinds of anxiety I talked about, little kids, it's very relevant for camp, where if a little kid is starting school, can have separation anxiety. So they can be anxious because they've spent so much time with mom and dad or grandma and grandpa or whoever you put in their life, and suddenly they have to go to this new place and they don't see the people who they're attached to. And that is a kind of anxiety that in its extreme version can be, can make it difficult for a child to be involved in school or in camp and acclimate to that new environment. But many kids experience that at some level in moderation. So your question was about how do we help someone, a little kid, develop an emotional vocabulary. I think it's just as important as, you know, when kids go to school, they take math class, they take English, they take history, but we don't have a class on emotions. But I really, there's a part of me that thinks maybe we should have something like that, because children need to be able to have words for what they're feeling. And when they don't, sometimes the anxiety can actually then get in the way of doing well in school or making friends that families want to see for those kids.
So I think that in our yeshivas, in our schools now, we have therapists that are in the schools doing a lot of prevention work, and the parents can ask the schools to request, all parents could request that the schools do certain programs for the elementary age kids. So it's a good idea. There are available programs. We need to have more in the schools, but if it comes from the PTA, from the parent body, then it's a good idea that the parent body asks the schools, literally calls the schools and says, can we get more mental health programs to prevent at-risk behaviors, including all mental health issues, in the elementary age schools, so that this way we can save kids early on by, like you said, learning language that may help them describe what they're feeling at a very young age.
Absolutely, I agree with you. And not to get political, but I will say, former Secretary Clinton had a saying that I think is very applicable here: it takes a village to raise a child. And
it
really
does. It does indeed.
So, involving not just families, but schools and communities. I mean, I think particularly for your audience, the Jewish community, there are so many available supports within temple, within the schools, within the extended family, to help raise that kid up and help them know that it's okay to have anxiety and to talk to someone about it. That's the biggest barrier. Sometimes if a kid is feeling something, one, they might not have the language, or two, they might be scared to tell someone because they might feel, what does this mean about me? Does this mean I'm not normal? And, of course, we all know anxiety is something that many people have, so making kids feel safe and loved so that they know when they're feeling something that's giving them a hard time that they can go talk to someone. Your point about schools is very well taken. I think early education is an important form of prevention.
Yes. For the listeners that are just coming on now, I just want to introduce you again, Dr. Alexandra Straightener, PhD, Dr. Alex, I want to ask you, can you describe again the common body symptoms that could happen when one has anxiety?
Sure. So in terms of physical symptoms that one has when they're experiencing anxiety, we think of I'll step back for a minute. Anxiety has an evolutionary background, right? So it used to be the case way, way back in the day that we had anxiety because we had to protect ourselves from whatever was in the environment. So I often joke when I'm seeing little kids, you have anxiety because an earlier version of you had to be able to run away from a bear. So our body naturally has this, what we call a fight or flight response that kicks in when we are in life-threatening circumstances. But in, you know, the modern day, rarely are we running from a bear. Anxiety still kicks in. It may not be a life-threatening circumstance, but we experience it as being life-threatening. But the physiological symptoms, the physical symptoms that we have when we experience anxiety are related to that fight or flight. So the things we experience are kind of the things that we would need to be able to run away from a bear, if you will. I know that's sort of silly, but your blood pressure might go up. Your heart rate might speed up. You might find that you get sweaty or clammy. Some people, when they feel nervous, find that they get stomach aches or stomach cramps, and that's because parts of your body where energy would typically go to help with digestion, energy isn't going there because, again, all the energy has to go to you surviving from that evolutionary standpoint. So instead of fueling digestion, it's fueling things like if you needed to run. So you might find that you have stomach troubles because digestion shuts down. Sometimes people feel dizzy or lightheaded. So those are some of the physical symptoms. The other one that people often see is shakiness. So you might notice, like a little kid who finds that they may look fidgety or their hands may be a little shaky. You might even hear it in their voice. So those are some of the things that you can visibly see if someone is experiencing acute anxiety.
And what about an older person? Can we speak about somebody that's in their 40s, 50s? Are there...
Sure.
Body symptoms the same as younger people with anxiety?
They are much the same. I would say that if anxiety is chronic for someone of an older age, then you might start seeing chronic symptoms that develop secondary to the anxiety. Things like headaches, aches and pains, lower back pain, things of that nature. You can also, of course, and this is why it's so important to address anxiety, you can have people who, because of chronic untreated anxiety, have medical conditions that develop, like high blood pressure, or you might have someone who, because of certain behaviors, when they feel anxious or overwhelmed, for example, there are some people who like to eat sweets or, you know, eat emotionally when they're feeling anxious. So you could potentially see metabolic impact of that. So that's why, to go back to prevention, it's so important we start addressing this with young kids, to give them the language and make them feel like there isn't a stigma around this. Because if not, in time, as that anxiety continues to develop and is untreated, it's clear that really cause medical concern. So those are some of the things you might see, but truly, the core anxiety symptoms look very much the same in a younger person as they do.
So, Dr. Alex, I'm wondering, what is the treatment for when people have anxiety? Can you offer the different kinds of treatments for younger people with anxiety? And for older people, are they the same? Are they different?
Sure. So one thing I will say is that Anxiety can be seen alone, but it can also be seen co-occurring with other kinds of conditions. So someone might have anxiety and depression, or, and this is an area that I work in primarily, they may have anxiety that they self-medicate by using substances. You could see someone with anxiety and an addiction. And the addiction might have developed because someone was trying to find a way of coping with anxiety, so they turned to alcohol or other substances. So treatment depends on what the presentation is. Are we looking at someone who just has, not just, that's minimizing, but whose primary concern is solely related to anxiety? Are we looking at someone who has multiple, what we call co-occurring diagnoses? If we're talking just about anxiety, treatment can involve many things. Treatment typically, I would say, involves psychotherapy, and in some instances can also involve medication. For some people, actually, often antidepressant medication can be helpful to some extent in managing anxiety. But the real core treatment, I would say, is psychotherapy. And there are different camps and different theorists who say that you treat anxiety differently. In what I would say is the gold standard, we're talking about cognitive behavioral therapy. And what cognitive behavioral therapy is people go and talk to a therapist, and they talk about some thoughts they might have that might fuel the anxiety they're experiencing. And then they do what's called reframing. So they evaluate, is this thought useful to me? Does this thought really make sense? And they talk that over with a therapist, and they identify some alternative ways of thinking. Some other components of treatment, particularly within cognitive behaviorism, could be things like mindfulness, which is a hot word now. I'm sure a lot of listeners have heard it. Mindfulness meditation, which is about using different kinds of relaxation exercises and bringing yourself to the present moment so that you can be more in touch with what you're experiencing. Often someone who's experiencing anxiety may not always have insight or be in touch with the thoughts. They may just suddenly have a flurry, if you will, of symptoms, physical symptoms. And they may not realize that the symptoms are connected to a certain thought they're having that's very anxiety-provoking. So mindfulness can be useful to help people be more in touch with their actual physical and cognitive experiences. And another thing that can be used, particularly with phobias or with panic disorder, panic attacks, is what we call graduated exposure and or flooding. Those are specific types of therapies where someone is exposed to something that they're afraid of in a therapeutic context so that it is safe. And through the exposure, they learn that what they were afraid of is not as scary, that the feared possibility is the anticipated consequences of, for example, seeing a spider, that the spider won't necessarily hurt them, and that helps diminish the anxiety. So these are just some things we can use, but if someone is experiencing anxiety or has a child or a teenager who's experiencing anxiety, my recommendation would first be to go get an evaluation with a mental health professional, someone like a psychologist or a psychiatrist, and you can even find that person through a school or through a pediatrician or a family physician. Go get an evaluation, and the doctor who you see will tailor the treatment needs based on the specific thing that you're experiencing and the research out there on how to treat that.
Right. So, and also we can add that you can call MASC, Mothers and Fathers Alliance.
Absolutely.
Saving Kids. And our number is 718-758-0400. We work with the pediatricians in the communities, and we refer to specialists that do evaluations, like Dr. Alex just described. For the new listeners, we have Dr. Alexandra Straightner. And we are talking about anxiety. If somebody would like to speak to Dr. Alexandra Straitner, you can call our number, 718-758-0400, and we will get you to Dr. Alex. So I'm wondering if we can now go on to adults. We've been talking about children. And can we talk about adults? There are times that parents call in for themselves to our helpline, and they describe their anxiety, and they say, my husband doesn't or my wife doesn't understand. They say, could you just snap out of it? What is that? Why do you keep on saying it makes you, you know, you're feeling like you can't sleep, you can't concentrate, you're constantly worrying. What about the adult? Can we talk about that, please?
Sure. So when it comes to adults with anxiety, I think that, as with kids, there's a lot of stigma, and that's what I hear you describing with the family member who just doesn't necessarily understand. Why is it that you're not sleeping? Why are you not eating? Why are you constantly describing these worries that you're having that are getting in the way of us enjoying our life together, if it's a marriage or, you know, a parent looking at a person, you know, going off to college or starting a career, and they're finding that their anxiety is becoming a barrier. And anxiety is something, as much as we know it's out there and it's very common, that's poorly understood, I'd say, generally. It's not that the person who's experiencing the anxiety wants to be viewed by others as anxious. But in a sense, sometimes anxiety can feel out of control. And so coming to a discussion with a loved one about their anxiety, you want to approach it non-judgmentally and try to be understanding. This is not, no one with anxiety wants to cause a burden, make their loved ones worry about them. But it feels uncontrollable. That's actually part of what makes it anxiety versus what we could call a quote-unquote normal worry. It feels like something that you cannot control. In the work that I do, which in psychotherapy, I use a specific model, both myself and my father, called carefrontation. And we use that when we're working with people with substance use and co-occurring concerns, because addiction can also be very stigmatized, especially if somebody is using illicit substances, or they're using in such a way that it's having a negative effect on their family. But I think that carefrontation can be applied to talking to someone with anxiety too, and really what's at the core, the foundation of carefrontation, the spirit of this model is, we don't blame or shame someone, but we hold them accountable for addressing their concern. This is sort of like if someone has a medical condition like diabetes. We wouldn't ever blame or shame someone for having diabetes, but we would expect them, if they needed to make sure that they were adhering with whatever the requirements of their treatment were, whether it was diet and exercise regimen or taking insulin. This is similar for mental health treatment. We don't blame or shame someone for having anxiety, but we ask them and expect them to be accountable for getting help and doing what they can to help themselves. So if I was a loved one and I saw someone I knew suffering with anxiety, I would say, I love you, I care about you, I'm available, I'm here. How can I help you get the help you need? Because I don't want to see you going through this anymore. Instead of, why are you doing this? Just get over it. Trust me, anyone with anxiety, if they could just get over it, they would. No one wants to feel that way, I promise.
Yes. How would you describe to counselors? We're going to camps. Kids are going away at the end of the month. Kids get to camp. The counselors are with them. Separation anxiety. What words should the counselors use when trying to comfort the children in camp?
That's a great question. And I was never a sleepaway camp counselor, but I was a day camp counselor for 2 years with little kids who sometimes had separation anxiety. So it warms my heart to think I'm speaking to some camp counselors out there potentially, because I remember being in their shoes. If a child is experiencing separation anxiety, again, it's sort of similar to holding a parent role. This could even be true with teachers for back to school. Trying to come to that child from a place of understanding and saying, I know this is hard, while knowing, and this is something that's important to know, that many kids who look like they have separation anxiety, they will, in psychology we say, habituate. They will get used to the new circumstances. Kids are pretty adaptable. And so typically they will get used to it, find something they enjoy doing, make them feel as if they were at home, like you really care about them, which camp counselors do. That's part of why you do this. And in time, they'll start having fun, and they'll forget that they're away from home. But it's usually at the beginning, it's at the drop-off, that someone might feel particularly anxious, homesick, have separation anxiety. And so just trying to say, I'm here for you, and you can talk to me. Make that child feel like you are the stable source of support that they experience at home. That's the reason they feel so connected and attached to mom and dad. Now, I will say, sometimes a child may have what looks like separation anxiety, and it's because there's something going on at home that they're worried about knowing that mom and dad are going to be okay, or whoever makes up the family when they get home. And so that's a little bit different, but again, in either of these situations, just being able to show love to a child, to show unconditional positive regard, that you're there for them, that you support them, and if they want to talk, you're there to talk. That can mean everything to a child, because it's about safety. To go back to the bear.
Right. Anxiety, can we do that? Can we describe again the definition of anxiety for the new listeners that may be just coming on now?
So anxiety, as I said before, is something that is biopsychosocial, and that means that it has it can be caused by a combination of factors, including biological or genetic factors, social contextual factors, being in a peer group or being in different circumstances, and psychological factors that are internal to the person, intrapersonal, things like emotions and thoughts. And what I was saying before about this bear that I keep talking about is that anxiety really is an evolutionary response at its core. It's about fight or flight when you're in a life-threatening circumstance. So the opposite of anxiety, if we think about life-threatening being why we have anxiety, the opposite of anxiety is safety. So for that camp counselor, for that teacher, for that parent, helping a child feel safe, in addition, when the symptoms are so great that they are interfering in the child's life, to getting them seen by burdens. But in addition to that, providing a stable support and a sense of safety, what we would call in psychology a holding environment for the child, can be very important. So that's what I'd say to those camp counselors. And the kids will make friends, and they'll find activities that they like to do, and that doesn't mean that they won't be anxious at times. The other thing is, some anxiety in moderate amounts is a part of life. It isn't adaptive, because sometimes anxiety can be motivating. So this is particularly true with work and school. If you have a big project coming up, a little bit of anxiety will push you to study for the test. So that's what I would say. But just providing a sense of safety and support can be so big in a child's life in many areas, and particularly for a child who might be predisposed to be a little bit anxious.
Okay, well, thank you for that again, that definition. of anxiety. Again, we are from MASC, Mothers and Fathers Aligned Saving Kids. And this is Ruchama Bistritsky-Klantman. And we are on every Thursday night from 9 to 10. And we speak about family matters. And our goal is for increased awareness, early intervention, and access to treatment. So feel free to call 718-758-0400 from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. for a referral for your family member, for your friend, for someone you sit near in shul. Call us. Give the number to somebody that may need it to get a referral to come to a support group with other parents that are struggling with different issues, all mental health issues, including drugs and alcohol, all at-risk behaviors. We have groups. Dr. Tricia Tia runs a group. Sarah Kahan. We have Dr. Bencion Twersky. Just call the MASC office, 718-758-0400, and you can ask about our groups, the days, the times, and the staff here will be able to help give you the information and referrals that you may need, including what Dr. Alex mentioned about having an evaluation done for somebody that has anxiety. Call 718-758-0400. Dr. Alex, I'd like to ask you, you mentioned about working with clients with drugs and alcohol issues. Can we focus now a little bit on the drugs and alcohol? What happens if there is a young adult that is self-medicating because their parent may not even know that they have anxiety, that child, and they never, you know, described what they were feeling when they were younger, and now they are in high school, they're getting, you know, some illegal substance, and they're self-medicating. And then the parent finds out that they are dealing with this issue. Can you talk about what happens when they do self-medicate?
Sure. I think that self-medication is very common in people who develop substance use concerns. That's a big reason that people might turn to substances. And just to go back briefly, if we're sort of progressing the narrative of a child, this does not happen with all children, but a child who has anxiety, who feels like they don't know that they have anxiety, they're not in touch with what it is, or they don't have adequate support, that child, when they start to become preteen, teenager, or young adult, might turn to substances because, for example, their friend offers them alcohol or they offer them marijuana or some other substance, and it changes their psychological experience temporarily and makes some of what you and I know to be emotional suffering, anxiety, depression, etc., go away. It puts it in the background for a little bit. We know it doesn't work in the long run, but that's often how substance use disorders can develop. So if a parent finds out, and this is the common way that this occurs, if a parent discovers or school discovers, an adult in this young person's life discovers that they're self-medicating with using substances, you again want to come from a place of not shaming, not blaming, being caring, but holding that young adult or teenager accountable. I understand you're going through a lot right now, and let's see if we can help you find a different way of managing that. Oftentimes when someone is experiencing addiction, they may not be in touch with, or they may be in denial about the fact that they have a concern. They might say, this is not a problem for me. All my friends, especially young people, all my friends drink, all my friends smoke pot. Don't worry about it. But we know that these substances do have an effect on the developing brain, and when at any age somebody develops an addiction, that it impairs the ability of that person to function and to be effective in any kind of role that they have, whether it's with family, in school, in work. So when you find out that a young person is struggling with substance use, try to come to them not from a place of shame or blame, because that will only raise their defenses and push them further away and further from help. Try to come to it from a place of wanting them to get help and being open to hearing their experiences and understanding what is maybe making you feel like you have to drink, what's making you feel like you have to use marijuana or another substance. And then the next step is very similar with anxiety. I would encourage parents, loved ones, to help that young person get an evaluation with a psychologist, a psychiatrist, or a doctor who specializes in addiction, who knows what addiction looks like in young people and can help identify different treatment options. And for some people, that might be going inpatient to a program for a period of time to get off of a substance and do some intensive work. And for some people, you can do that outpatient and have therapy and a psychiatrist and stop using a substance outpatient. And often it does involve group treatment as well. I know I heard you mention groups many times. Groups can be so wonderful as a unique source of support, especially for young people, because with a young person, a doctor is another grown-up. But if they can be in a group with peers around their own age who are experiencing the same things, that's a sense of support that's really, it can really be profound. So, but try to come with all of this, come from a place of love. It can be hard at times because parents can have anxiety about the fact that their child or another loved one is having anxiety or dealing with addiction, or parents can feel angry or like the child let them down. These are all understandable responses, but coming to it from a place of love, trying to get back to that core, why is it that you're feeling scared about your child? Because you love them. So coming to it from a place of love, I want to get you help. Help me understand what's been going on, instead of a place of, you know, strict confrontation. You're going to stop doing this. You're in trouble. We never want to punish shame or blame. This is a disease.
But the good thing is that the more awareness out there, Dr. Alex, the more prevention, the more conversations, the more times that we talk to kids when they're younger, then it's easier for them as they get older and things get tougher for them, whether it's high school, college, or whatever life struggles they may face. If we give them the language to describe what they're feeling when they're younger, that can help them when they get older, resisting the temptation of going for the drugs, alcohol, and all the at-risk behaviors. So
absolutely,
that very, very young conversation is what we need to have more often with the young children, elementary age kids, so to prevent this from becoming a problem as they get older, mm-hmm. whether it's school or in life.
Can I throw a thought out there? Speaking of, sure. I've heard you mention masks and prevention. If you're a parent or a loved one and you have a family member, or if you yourself are struggling with something, I would say don't be afraid to call. You've been through so much for so long. A lot of people go through this. You're not alone. So never be afraid to reach out for help. There will always, especially with an organization like yours, what a wonderful thing, there's always someone there to help. If you just reach out, they're there. So I would say that to families, because I think with mental illness, there's a lot, as you've said, a lot of stigma. And it keeps people from getting help, which is a terrible thing. But you're not alone. You never have to be alone.
Yes, I would like to read a personal story from someone where she writes, I was worried all the time about everything. It didn't matter that there were no signs of problems. I just got upset. I wasn't having trouble falling asleep at night. I'm sorry, I was having trouble falling asleep at night, and I couldn't keep my mind focused at work. I felt angry at my family all the time. I saw my doctor and explained my constant worries. My doctor sent me to someone who knows about general anxiety disorder. Now I'm taking medicine and working with a counselor to cope better with my worries. I had to work hard, but I feel better. I'm glad I made that first call. And that's like exactly what you're saying. People should not be alone in this. There are mm-hmm. organizations out there like MASC or Call MASC, Mothers and Fathers Alliance Saving Kids, 718-758-0400. Call for yourself if it's not about your child. Call for your married children. Call for your spouses. Give our number to your friends that tell you that they have anxiety. Suggest to them to call so that they can get the help they need. We do have support groups. There are support groups for mental health issues, for the spouses, for the family members, for themselves, people with mental health issues. Call MASC. We'll give you all the information. And there's no reason that anybody should go through this alone. The stigma, like you said, Dr. Alex, we need to fight hard together to take off the mask so that parents, family members can get the help they need through their days or their nights and not have an issue with sleeping or eating or physical anxiety that may be causing them headaches, muscle tension, trembling, you said, sweating, nausea. These are all things that can come with anxiety. Dr. Alex, we were talking about kids that, or adults, young adults, even married, older adults, that do, you know, pick up that illegal drug. The opiates, they go to the medicine cabinets of their family members. They're taking painkillers that somebody may have had a toothache or they had an operation or an accident, God forbid, and they have leftover painkillers that are not being used. And they're in the cabinet and someone's not feeling well. They have anxiety. They can't shake the feeling. And they may pick up somebody else's medication in their home, in their own home. So they self-medicate. Then it could become an addiction issue like we talked about. What happens that we find a lot with parents is that they'll call or they'll come to group or they're in the rehab, the parent group, and they say, okay, my child is now clean. He detoxed. She went to therapy. She's coming out 90 days of an inpatient rehab. She's in an intensive outpatient program. Why is she having anxiety now? Can we talk about when the parent doesn't know originally that they may have anxiety and it looked masked like something else?
Mm-hmm. So when someone comes out of an intensive program for substance use treatment and they are now abstinent from substances with sober, essentially, what's been done, this is going to sound funny for a moment, is that we've taken away their best coping skill. It's not the best coping skill, but it was their best coping skill. So because often someone is self-medicating, as you said, with opiates, a young person goes into the family's medicine cabinet, they're feeling anxious, they reach for something, and then this is how we see, you know, an opiate addiction develop, this epidemic, horrifying epidemic that we have. It was because they were trying to treat something or make something go away to start. And now that we've treated the addiction, that understandably is going to start to come back because it was the substance that was their way of coping. So you took away the one thing they had to cope with. As they go through therapy in time and they start to reacclimate to different parts of their life, they will begin to learn through therapy new coping skills and new ways of managing that are not using a substance. But at the beginning, as they go through these new experiences, the first year we really say is the early recovery period. As they start to go back into their life after they've been maybe in an inpatient treatment and they're reacclimating to life, it's very understandable to have some transitional anxiety. The other thing is that because substances have biological, neurological, physiological effects, they also have some symptoms of withdrawal or post-acute withdrawal or actual, because of the physiological effect of the substance, induced symptoms of the substance that could look like anxiety. And in fact, are anxiety, but they were created by way of substance use. So when someone is in that early recovery period, it's very understandable, in fact, that these symptoms that might have been dormant for a while might reemerge. And helping somebody through that transitional period in therapy, through supportive services, to help them understand you're having anxiety, it's understandable, and here's a different way of trying to deal with your anxiety that you've used before, that can be immensely helpful.
So do these clients, these patients, do they get medicated for their anxiety when they come out of treatment?
That is something that I would say is very individualized. If someone has an evaluation by a psychologist and a psychiatrist and it's determined that they may have an underlying co-occurring disorder, they may have a primary anxiety disorder or a primary major depression. What I mean by that is that it's not simply them withdrawing from substances that's causing these symptoms, but this is something that underlined it, that they have been self-medicating all along. Then they might talk about starting a medication in addition to therapy. And most of the time, I would go so far as to say almost all of the time, what the research shows is that a combination for many things, like depression and anxiety, a combination of psychotherapy and at least at the beginning some medication is very helpful, because you want to help somebody get immediate management of their symptoms so that they don't have a substance use relapse while they're bolstering other skills that they can use to cope. So yes, sometimes medication can be a piece of this. It doesn't have to be a piece of this in all instances, but that's a decision that families and patients should make with their doctors. I certainly work with many people who do see a psychiatrist for medication, and I work very closely with those psychiatrists. We're a treatment team. But I also see some people who are not on medication, and then we manage this in other ways.
So treatment does offer relief. And we just need to pick up the phone to call, to ask the questions, to see what's available, to see what sort of doctors treat anxiety, what sort of therapists, what they use to treat the anxiety, what form of counseling is available, what medications are available for anxiety. These are all important questions that parents can call MASC 718-758-0400, and we can connect you to the right specialist, the right therapist, the right psychiatrist, the right doctor, the right psychologist, the right inpatient or outpatient program, and we can help guide you to get the right relief, the right treatment that one may need when facing issues such as anxiety, drugs, alcohol, eating disorders, post-traumatic stress disorder, all mental health issues and at-risk behaviors. You can call MASC 718-758-0400. Dr. Alex, tonight is our eighth radio program. We've had programs about eating disorders. We've had programs where parents, moms talk about their family members that was on drugs and alcohol. We have a dad on the program. Anyone interested in listening to our past programs, go on to talklinecommunications.com and listen to our programs. We are here every Thursday night from 9 to 10, and I'd like to thank Dr. Alexandra Straightner. Thank you, Dr. Alex. We can go on and talk a long time about anxiety and drugs and alcohol and treatment. I hope to have you on again, and it was really great having you, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure. Congratulations on the show, and just thank you. This is such an important topic, and I'm so happy to be able to speak with you.
Thank you. Anybody that wants to reach Dr. Alexandra Straightner, please call MASC 718-758-0400. And I want to wish everyone this evening a very good Shabbos. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Jay Booksbaum. You know me probably from wine and spirits, but I want to tell you something. Even though I'm in that area of expertise, Rachama Bistritsky-Klapman, who runs MASC, Mothers and Fathers, the Line Saving Kids, they're in their 20th anniversary. They've got over 45,000 families that they've helped over the years. It's an amazing program. It's called Family Matters, and if you've got any issues with bullying or alcohol or substance abuse or any other kind of abuse, they're your place to go. I'm really excited to introduce you all to Rachama Bistritsky-Klapman here on Deb Brenner's Talk Line Communications Network every Thursday night at 9 o'clock. Listen to Rachama and Family Matters.
Please become a fan of Talk Line with Zeb Brenner on Facebook, LinkedIn, Google Plus, and YouTube. On Twitter at Talk Line Network. If you have an Android phone, please download our free app in the Google Store. For iPhones, download the Jewish Radio app. Of course, tune in 24 hours a day at TalkLineCommunications.com or our 24-hour-a-day listen line at 401-347-0304, extension 1, for non-stop Jewish broadcasting.
It pays to tune in on Saturday night, June 10th at midnight for a special Talk Line with Zev Brenner broadcast on WMCA 570 AM and TalkLineCommunications.com with Yoli Friedman, CEO of Credit Capital, answering your questions about your credit, how it works, and utilizing your credit for investment and other financial matters. Don't miss it. It pays to tune in.
אביר הרים צלול כיין וריח אורני.
If you'd like to win a pair of tickets to hear Dudu Fischer live in concert Sunday, June 11th at 5 p.m. at the Stryker Center, 1 East 65th Street of Manhattan, then email us at zev@talklinecommunications.com. That's zev@talklinecommunications.com. The first five people that email us will receive a pair of tickets. You can also call us at 212-769-1925, extension 100. We're giving away five pairs of tickets. First five people that call us, 212-769-1925. 1925 extension 100 if you want any prize in the last 30 days, or if you don't have an email address, you're not eligible to win. Again, 212-769-1925 extension 100. Leave a message or ZEV at talklinecommunications.com.